Blog Talk Radio.
Everyone, this is the Sound Health Options Show with Richard Talk to Me Guy and Sherry Edwards. Good morning, Sherry.
Good morning, Richard. Beautiful, beautiful morning. And I've just lost all of my notes here that I had in front of me. But we want to talk about freedom and health freedom today. And we have an old friend with us, been with us many times. He works with many different organizations, Ralph Husatola, JD, and he is a fighter for health freedom. And we're going to open up the phone lines and you can ask him questions about anything. I want to ask him about jury nullification and what we can do from inside the system. So it's going to be a wonderful show for our audience and information alike. And in this show, we try to bring you ideas to help your life be better. And I think of anything that's happened in the United States, I think freedom, not just health freedom, but freedom to think and to do and to have and to act, all of those are incredibly important. And what I'm hoping this show will do is help you set America free, because that in turn helps us free. We should let people know we're simultaneously broadcasting on Blog Talk Radio over there with Richard, 347-850-1407. And we are thinking strongly of not doing a WebEx for the Sunday show, because we get credit at Blog Talk Radio for everybody that bops in over there. And the more people who bop in, the higher rating we get, so they will advertise the show more. So even if you are here with us on WebEx, jump over there, jump into Blog Talk Radio, so we'll get credit for it. We also, WebEx, if you want to join us, go to our site, soundhealthoptions.com. And it's on the radio page, just Blog Talk Radio. And you'll see a picture of smiling Ralph there, who we are going to talk to in a few minutes, just after some announcements. Richard, do you want to go first?
Sure. I'll start out by saying, for people that are, depending upon which side you're on, that anybody can go to soundhealthoptions.com, click on the radio tab, and then for today's show, click on Blog Talk Radio, and down there on the right-hand side is, as Sherry said, the phone number for Blog Talk Radio if you want to call in and listen at 347-850-1407. There's also a link there that if you want to join the chat over at Blog Talk Radio, you can. And there is still, because we're in discussion about the eliminating WebEx, there's a WebEx link where you can join the chat there and watch what we're talking about as well. Now, my first announcement, I am happy to say that the state of California governor, Jerry Brown, if you can put that graphic up, Sherry, that'd be great, actually took action this week at the end of the week. I can't remember if it was yesterday or, Friday or Thursday. Actually wrote laws, bills, saying in California that you need a background check to buy ammo, that there are restrictions on lending guns or purchasing guns for others, and there are going to be actual penalties for false reports. And for me, the big one, that's all good, and the big one is limiting the magazine capacity of guns. And also this very interesting loophole that the gun manufacturers put in with guns with magazines. A magazine is a thing that holds the bullets, many bullets, so that you can shoot, I don't know the actual numbers, but, a lot of bullets. And they did this workaround by having a release button that required a pin or something special to cause the magazine to drop out. And so what that meant is that gun manufacturers could say, oh, that magazine is, you know, locked and loaded into the gun, therefore it changed the ruling on what kind of gun was called. And Governor Brown said that is no longer going to be approved, so that, because it still means that even if you need a special device to pop the magazine out, it still means that you could have, you know, how many ever magazines you could carry full of gun bullets with you, pop that out, drop it to the ground, and slap another one in. So you still have an automatic weapon with magazine-filled bullets that are killing people. So Governor Brown took action. I'm happy about that.
I would like to add two things.
I think it's, you know,
I
hope this becomes a trend, since the government seems
to
be owned by the NRA, which I would remind people, there are really only 4 million members of the NRA. There may be up and down, but I mean that's really not that many people to have such an amazing effect on the rest of our lives. I'm not anti-gun. I'm an intelligent gun, and I still feel there's virtually no reason for somebody to own a weapon that is used in the military exclusively for killing people. It's not a hunting weapon like the AK-15 is what I'm talking about. I see no value in that. So there's that. Then,
Richard, are you not
hearing
me?
Jump over to
Hello?
That other link with Whole Foods, and this slightly blows my mind.
I don't have that one.
But Whole Foods, the CEO of Whole Foods, they jumped on board with Congress saying that they want to kill the labeling across America, the GMO labeling, which is trying to go forward right now. Now, the CEO of... Oh, I'm not hearing you. Why am I not hearing you? Hold on, I just got a message from Sherry. No, you're unmuted over here, Sherry.
Well, I see me speaking here also.
I'll keep talking for a minute. That the CEO of Whole Foods on social media is saying, no, I didn't say that. But then there's video footage, and this is reported in Mike Adams' Natural News up at the show note, this link in both show notes, saying exactly that. Let's kill this GMO labeling bill. So, you know, and this is a great question for Ralph, once, you know, as soon as we introduce Ralph. How do we have an effect on that? What do we as the people, I mean, it's about us. I know this is a shocking concept, but it's about us. It's not about them. It's supposed to be about, you know, we the people, at least in my theory. So I find that disgusting that Whole Foods is advocating for not labeling things that are GMO. So those are my announcements. And I'm not hearing you, Sherry.
I can't understand why not.
That's interesting. I hear you. Hold on a second. I hear you at there, but not over here. Try that again, Sherry.
Okay, we can try now. Hello, hello.
Go ahead. No, I hear you. I hear you now.
Okay, well, I have your link up, but I wanted to make an announcement about the gun. You know, when you first showed me that, I considered it a magazine that you read, and I thought that was censorship. So don't make that mistake. A gun magazine is very different from a magazine that you read. So the other announcement was, this is not about guns that you would use for target practice or to defend your home. This is guns of war and multi-splayed bullets, hundreds at a time. This is a war gun that they're trying to contain. Okay, go ahead.
No, I'm handing it off to you now. While I was trying to figure out how to unmute you, I was ranting.
Oh, Whole Foods confirms it knowingly sells products containing Monsanto's genetically modified corn. So this is one that you wanted brought forward. And now I'm not hearing Richard. Okay, I will just go on with what I was saying then. We had a lady come to us and say that she was on Xarelto, which is a blood thinner, and you can't just go off of it. And they upped it from 300 and some $1,000 a month to $1,300. And we made that announcement, and some other people are coming up and showing. Here is Kroger Pharmaceuticals, and this one I think is for Farxiga, which is a diabetic pill. And here are some of the prices in America. Here are some of the prices in Canada. And there is, I think this one's it, Xarelto tablets. And here is the cost through insurance, $923.60 plus $120 for the person that's buying it, and that makes it well over $1,000. We've talked about this before, and it's crazy that people would be paying that for a life-saving pill. Even $120 a month, if you're on two or three pills, is way more than most people can afford. And I think they are upping the price of these medications so that they can control people through medications. They're trying it with food, with GMOs. They're trying it with water, with fluoride. Now they're trying it with medications. And that leads me into an article someone sent me. Except for the rich, Americans' incomes fell last year. The top 1% of 1% got raises. But this is crazy that people get a bonus. Our president here of the university got a bonus for 1 year. A raise that was more than four people's salaries for a year at the university. And that just seems kind of crazy. But if you're in this range, I wanted you to be able to look at it and see, while the majority of incomes fell, consumer spending, which accounts for about two-thirds of the U.S. economy, rose 1%. So we're making less, but we're having to spend more, like on medications and foods and things that are poisoning us. So this is a very interesting article, and it leads me to the next one that I'm just furious about. And again, one of our listeners sent this in. Billionaire logically fears poor will revolt against the rich. And in this article down through here, he says that they are the uneducated masses. They should understand that we're smarter than them. We know what's best for them, and they should just shut up and obey. I'm reading from the article now that I put in chat. There are 7 billion people in the world and only a few hundred grotesquely wealthy people. As people become more desperate to care for themselves and their struggling families in a world where rich people are making more money they don't need off the backs of the working poor. It won't be long before people get so fed up that they literally band together to bring down the greedy a-holes who care more about owning the world than they do about people who live in it. We see that right now with our political situation, and it's happening, and these people who think they are in the know and have the most money. Whoever has the most money gets to make the rules. And I have known Ralph Husatola for over 20 years. And since the very first time I ever met him, he was working toward freedom of vaccines and health and government and money and IRS and everything else. He saw this coming. It's just incredible. And through the years, I've been there while Ralph helped people over some pretty rough spots where the government were coming in and trying to take over their company. He's taken our courses. He serves on our board, and his wife, Kathy, is a bioacoustic provider, although it is like pulling teeth to get any kind of case study out of here, out of her. So Ralph has worked with many government agencies and health-oriented organizations. He's a personal friend of at least one very high-up person at Fox News, and he can mention that person if he wants. He's been at the foundational level of many organizations. And, Ralph, I just thought about this over the years, and correct me if I'm wrong, that you were there at the beginning of the Libertarian Party. You were at the beginning of the Life Extension Foundation with Dirk Pearson and Sandy Shaw. You were involved in Dr. Levine's case in New York that allowed doctors, before Obamacare, allowed a doctor and a patient to have an exclusive relationship. And I've often said about Ralph's work with bioacoustics, which he does a lot of it free of charge, will earn him a special place in heaven, and I think after this show it will earn him a place in your business of bioacoustics and your information and avenues for being somebody who really thinks we deserve health freedom. Ralph, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Sherry. That's a very gracious introduction. It makes more of my career than I probably actually experienced. But now that I'm a retired lawyer, I'm allowed to look back at it in different ways. It is true I was involved with, and have been ever since, involved with libertarians since the 1960s. Yes, I, along with Hillary Clinton, I was a youthful Goldwater. Hillary went one way, I went a different way. In the late 1960s, in the ferment of that era, you know, various political philosophies were discussed by many people. Libertarianism seemed to be the clearest and most consistent with my ideas of justice and right. And so it was logical to get involved with that. I was not at the actual organizational meeting that formed the LP, because there were other organizations before that, like the Society for Individual Liberty and whatnot, that I was involved in. And I remember back in 1971, the great and venerable Ludwig von Mises, the great philosopher who had escaped the Nazis and lived out his last few decades in the United States, died in his 90s in, I think, 71, 72, a few months after he spoke to us, spoke to a group of incipient libertarians, young libertarians, at that time young. One of them was the son of a Nobel Prize economist. The others became members of Congress and best-selling authors. Dirk Pearson and Sandy Shaw, for example, were there. And certainly it was a moment in which the baby boomer generation was coming of age and trying to figure out where to go. And Mises spoke to us all, and he at one point he wagged his finger at the audience, at these, you know, 20-something-year-olds who thought they understood everything about everything, as all 20-something-year-olds think. And they and he said to us, he looked at it and said, "You are eating your seed corn." I remember him saying that. "You're eating your seed corn." And, of course, in that sentence, he defined the entire history of the baby boomer generation. And he was absolutely correct on many different levels. Many different levels.
Ralph, what do you see now as causing most of the problem? That's part of the question. And then, how did you see it coming?
How did I see it coming? I don't know if I saw it coming. You know, back in 1979, I thought that we were about to have a big crack-up economic collapse. It looked like it that summer. In fact, it was July of 1979. An essay got mailed out to lots of people. It was not my essay, but it was mailed out, I'm sure, to hundreds of thousands of people. This is before the Internet, you know, when stale mail newsletters meant something. It was called The Upright Spike. I received 3 copies of it, so I know it went to a lot of people. And it was a series of graphs showing everything going to infinity by October of 79. And indeed, it looked like it. The inflation rate, the price of gold, anything you wanted to measure, interest rates, all of it going sky high, and it looked as though the crack up was then. Well, of course, what happened was the great boom of the 1980s. You know, so I can't claim any great great perception and when it comes to economic matters. It was pretty clear, however, in 2007 that there was going to be a bubble bursting, and it's pretty clear right now in 2016 that the biggest bubble of all, this finance bubble that was created by the huge amount of fiat currency created over the past decade, that that bubble is really on the edge of busting. And when that happens, I don't know. All games are on the table at that point. I believe gold will go very high. I believe that the dollar will be exposed as being, you know, something not unlike the Zimbabwe dollar. You know, yeah. And you know how these regimes end. It's when they run out of hard currency and can't print any more of their own paper. That's when they end. That's what happened in Zimbabwe, literally. They didn't have a couple of $1,000 to get a printing company off in Europe somewhere to print up new bills for them. And the same thing is happening right now in Venezuela, where they are running out of ink and paper to print up more money. So it's always the last stage. You know, less sophisticated societies need to put ink on paper. More sophisticated societies just simply change numbers in computers, which is what our Federal Reserve is very adept at. But, you know, Ron Paul, of course, had the proper solution to that, and I believe the libertarians have the proper solution, and that is, in the words of the great J.P. Morgan, who I think probably understood economics more than most anyone else in the 20th century, J.P. said, gold is money. All else is credit. And I think he was absolutely correct about that. I think time will tell, and eventually balance is restored. But when is the question?
I want to jump in and ask you a question in that realm. Do you think something like Bitcoin or these other electronic currencies with their chains, and, you know, I don't understand them that well, I'm just aware of them.
Yeah.
Do you
yeah.
think that they're an indicator of something, besides the
oh,
sort
yes.
of tech realms wanting to change something? And do
yes,
you think they have a
heavy,
potential
heavy
of covering
forces.
Our butts?
Yeah, I would say heavy market forces working against government currencies all around the world. We're really watching the end of trust in government currency monopolies. And in the future, the media of exchange, and I say media, more than one, right? The media of exchange will be as far divorced from politics as possible. We need to take away the money power from the politicians. What's needed is our market forces. They are the ones that can produce the best in terms of media of exchange. Look, the great F.A. Hayek, Nobel laureate in economics, the author of the great work, The Road to Serfdom, before he died, in his 80s, wrote a little booklet called The Denationalization of Money, in which he discusses how free market money might work. Now, this was written, I believe, in the early 90s. It may have been earlier. I don't recall when he passed. But, of course, he didn't have the knowledge of the electronic currency and that stuff. But he basically sketched out how what market forces would act in favor of a stable currency. And he foresees, and he fantasized a bit. He said, "What in the absence of political control, what would the market provide as a means of exchange?" And he explores that from a very proper economist's mode, and he comes to the conclusion that essentially the great financial institutions, stripped of their special legal privileges, because we're talking about the government getting out of the money system, right? You know, that these institutions have powerful financial interests in creating and maintaining stable media of exchange. And modern computers allow multiple media of exchange to interact. We already do it. You know, you can get a debit card in euros on a bank in Europe right now and take that same debit card physically, use it physically in the United States, and it will convert to dollars and deduct and all that stuff. It's all done automatically. So the technology is now here. The original the original excuse for government monopoly over money, that somehow it had, that's the only way it could operate, you needed a monopoly issuer, is no longer even technically true. And certainly we know from the history of the government currency interventions that they are disastrous in both long and short term. And what we really need to do is say that just like church and state had to be separated, we need to separate money and state. And, you know, ideally school and state and, you know, a few other things. But you know, money and state would be a good place to start because it's so obvious. We understand, and I don't think anyone except for the few remaining hardcore Marxists on this planet, I don't think anyone argues that government provides goods and services better than the market does. I mean, no one argues that position anymore. So why would government be needed to provide a medium exchange? Just like, you know, when the government monopoly over the postal service was abolished, we inaugurated an era of extraordinary change and development where it's becoming less and less expensive instead of more and more expensive to transport goods. And that happened only with the breaking up of the monopoly. What would happen if the U.S. government's monopoly over money were broken? You know, and it's a monopoly that, as you know, is unconstitutional, literally unconstitutional. When the founders developed the Constitution, one of the things they were reacting to was the horrendous inflation that occurred during the American Revolution. You know, the continental dollar started off being worth $1 in silver, you know, 20th of an ounce of gold, and at the end of the Revolution, it was 1,000 to an ounce of silver, 1,000 paper dollars to one silver coin. And that was the great inflation that led rise to the old saying, not worth a continental. Our grandchildren will say, not worth a buck. And it'll have the same meaning, because the dollar has evaporated. They had 1,000 to 1, destruction of the continental dollar. We've experienced, since the founding of the Federal Reserve, a 98-99% reduction in the value of the U.S. dollar. The U.S. dollar was defined in the, you know, and it's, remember, it's a constitutional standard that we're dealing with here, a standard that the government has ignored, literally. But we have a standard, and for the first century of the Republic, you know, $20 was an ounce of gold. And the government guaranteed a relationship between gold and silver at 16 ounces to 1 ounce. And by the way, J.P. Morgan would say that meant that silver was not money. Silver was another form of credit because the government was maintaining its value vis-a-vis gold. And that brings us to the entire historical issue of why did William Jennings Bryan say, do not crucify mankind on a cross of gold? What was he really talking about? But that's another story for another time.
I want to jump slightly for a moment.
Go ahead.
Because we're of a similar vintage. I just rewatched the movie Steal This Movie, which was the Abbie Hoffman story.
Yep.
And it wasn't a great movie. It was good. It was well worth seeing because for people who don't know who Abbie Hoffman was, he was I'll call him a thought leader. He was a wacky guy, but he was a thought leader and, you know, a founder of early protest in a big way, you know, words I can't
use
on air.
When I was in law school, I worked on the appeal of his defense in the Chicago 8 trial.
Wow.
And got to know him and Jerry Rubin. I got to know rather more in years later when Jerry became a capitalist. But that's another story. All right,
That's another story. That's a whole, like, amazing story, but I want to talk about backstage about Jerry Rubin. How did that happen? How did he go from there to there? That's amazing. But what my point is, do you think that – I really do recommend everybody see Steal This Movie. It's based on Abbie Hoffman's book, Steal This Book. But it's really – it's a good story, and partially it's good because it has so much real footage of things that actually happened that my question is, do you feel that we can still use protest as a means for expressing our desire for an act? Do you think that protest still has... Okay.
No question that feedback, that pushback works. By pushback includes physical protest sometimes when they're useful. And back in 1994, when we were working on the Dietary Supplement Health and Education Act, we had people picketing in front of FDA local offices around the country. Then sometimes that's useful. But in the modern world, with the new means of communication, the social media is so much more powerful in many ways. You know, there's going to be a huge amount of mess of physical demonstrations going on at the former Grand Old Party, now the Old Party, convention in a couple of weeks. And they, you know, those people, if they were at home on social media, would probably have a bigger impact. But anyway, we learned that pushback works a number of ways. You know, I'm one of the trustees at Natural Solutions Foundation, and we've worked on a number of health freedom issues over the past decade. And it seems each time that we generate large numbers of people contacting Congress, things happen. And I give as an example what happened in 2009 with the swine flu vaccine panic. And we generated millions of emails to Congress, and ultimately the entire dastardly government plan to get us all vaccinated with God knows what fell through, collapsed. And we believe that it's very clear that when the people are united, you know, they can have an effect. Now, ultimately, of course, it all goes back to the First and Second Amendment. You know, the First Amendment says that we have the right, not just the right to speak, but the right to petition the government for redress of grievances. And that's what we're doing when we're pushing back, you know. Second Amendment, of course, is the one that guarantees the First. Sherry, Richard, the Second Amendment is not about target shooting. It's not about hunting. The Second Amendment is the only one that, in its own words, tells us what it's about. It says, a well-regulated militia being necessary for a free state, comma, the right of the people to bear and keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Real clear. The militia was what maintained law and order, but the people had to be armed to protect them against the militia, the state. This wasn't an amendment that said a well-regulated militia being necessary for a free state, comma, the militia shall have the right to keep and bear arms. It doesn't say that. It says the people. And where it uses the people in the Bill of Rights, it means individual persons. That's why it uses that term in the amendments about our privacy. You know, we have a right, the people have a right to expect privacy in their papers and books and things. So I, you know, to me, the purpose of the Second Amendment is precisely for the people to be as well-armed, if possible, as the government. And therefore, I would say, not just AR-15s, which require you to pull the trigger each time, and therefore are not automatic weapons, but also truly automatic weapons. You know, anything that is an arm, the phrase keep and bear arms is significant. An arm is a weapon that can be handled and held by one person. So I would have to say that includes bazookas and other anti-tank weapons. So I'm taking a very hard position on that. I'm saying that the purpose of the Second Amendment is to defend the people against a government gone crazy, and indeed we have a government gone crazy.
There are many questions coming in. One of them relates exactly to what you're saying. If that is our right, how did the government get away with what they did in Boston of jerking everybody out of their house and searching their house at gunpoint?
The Constitution says, no state shall make anything but gold and silver legal tender. Yet you have in your pocket pieces of paper that say, this note is legal tender. How did that come to be? You know, there's only one clause that the Constitutional Convention actually voted out of the Constitution. It was a clause that said, Congress shall have the power to declare legal tender. They actually took that clause out of the draft of the Constitution and put in the clause about states making nothing but gold and silver legal tender, because they had taken away from Congress that authority, and therefore still resided in the states, and the states were to be limited. There was never a constitutional amendment changing that, and the American dollar is an act of violation. The legal tender notes that we are used to using and their electronic substitutes are each one of them an act of violence against the Constitution. And just because the Supreme Court allowed it, and there was the famous legal tender cases back in the 1870s, in which the Supreme Court first said the legal tender notes are only legal tender for debts that people owe to the government. The government can't make them legal tender for private. Only gold and silver can be legal tender for private debts. The Supreme Court.
What do we do about this?
Well, you know, what happened is the rump Congress, the Congress representing only 2/3 of the states, controlled by the Republican Party, increased the size of the Supreme Court and appointed 2 new members, one of whom had the last name of Chase. And the Supreme Court reheard the legal tender cases and found inherent in sovereignty the right to declare legal tender. Whenever Supreme Court says inherent in sovereignty, it means we're usurping the Constitution. In my legal opinion, the usurpation of the Constitution never creates a precedent, and that an honest court, maybe a court in which the Chief Justice was Andrew Napolitano, that court would say nothing but gold and silver is legal tender. These Federal Reserve notes, no one has to accept except for the federal government. And then let's see what happens. Anyway.
Oh, this is incredible. What are the things that you think we, the people, can do against things like GMOs and vaccinations and rigged elections and lying Hillary and Benghazi? And where do we start?
I want to jump in there just for a second, Ralph, and focus you, particularly because this is happening in California now.
Yep.
This ruling on vaccines in California, now they're throwing out our right to, like, refuse or, you know, protest or not have it, and they're up in arms in Northern California about it. You know, moms are pulling kids out of school. How do we fight that? I mean, this goes to the whole big pattern.
Yeah. You know, the price of liberty is eternal vigilance.
In California, they were saying, no, you have to get your kids vaccinated if you're going to have them in daycare, period.
Well, let's listen to that. There's certain things we have to talk. That's a big case and a big issue, and I want to talk about it. But I want to preface it by saying that, as I said, the price of liberty is eternal vigilance. The only way we're going to survive as a free people is to stop trusting the politicians and pay attention and vote for anybody but a Republican or a Democrat. I mean, this is the year to vote third party. And if you don't, you're absolutely part of the problem. I think that Gary Johnson and Bill Weld, the governor's team, are two really seasoned politicians who come from a different background and different theory. And the fact that they are willing to run as libertarians suggests to me that they are serious about what they're doing and serious about being fiscally conservative and socially liberal, which I think is what the vast majority of this country really is. So I believe this is a unique year, and I believe that Donald Trump's hostile takeover of the former GOP, now the OP, the old party, that particular act and the Democrats' decision to give the nod to Hillary Clinton has created a unique circumstance in which people from both ends of the spectrum can converge. And it's not an unlikely thing. You know, the mass media, of course, covers up the important news all the time, so most people have never heard of this one. But in 2008, Ron Paul was able to bring together representatives of the 4 leading third parties in the country. The Green Party. The Green Party, the Libertarian Party, the Conservative Party, and Ralph Nader's Independent Party. And these 4 organizations got together, and they actually agreed on a 4-point program. There was a press conference at the National Press Club. Ron Paul was there. The chairman of the 4 parties were there. They issued a statement. And the 4 points that they made together, if they had been followed, would have prevented the Great Recession, of course, at the very least. But the fact that these 4 parties from right and left were able to get together on a four-part program that had to do with no increase in federal debt, no further increase in federal debt, basically ending the interventions abroad, going back to the founders' policy of non-intervention, and repealing the Patriot Act. Those are the things that were necessary to restore the republic. Now, that meeting was actually not covered by any of the media, except for the alternative media. We now have alternative media on the Internet, and so you can't hide everything. But the fact that happened suggests that this time around, the third parties are going to be even more able to cooperate on finally breaking this two-party monopoly, which is, I believe, at the root of all of the political problems of the country. There is no other so-called democracy which has this so-called two-party system, and it's about to break. You know, the Gallup poll has asked the question of, are the two parties doing an adequate job? Does there need to be a major third party? They've been asking that question for 50 years, I think actually more than 50 years. And up until 2007, a majority always said the two parties are doing an adequate job. In 2007, the lines crossed and have never recrossed. And now, the last one I saw was 62% favor the creation of a major third party. This is the election for that. So my first thought for anyone who wants to make a difference in this country is to vote third party. Vote for the Green candidate if you want to, but you know, there's a fleeting chance that the governor's team, Libertarian Party candidates, can actually get in. Here's a scenario. Let's imagine for a moment. Bill Weld carries his home state of Massachusetts, and Gary Johnson carries his home state of New Mexico, and maybe one or two other states. I don't know, maybe Arizona, who knows. But not even necessary. And Hillary and Trump divide up the electoral votes evenly, and nobody has the majority of the electoral votes, and therefore no one is elected president, that means. If that happens, the U.S. Senate, the new U.S. Senate, the one that meets at the beginning of January of next year, chooses the vice president from among the two top vote-getters in the Electoral College, and the U.S. Congress, the House of Representatives, chooses the president from among the top three Electoral College vote-getters. And they do that by casting one vote per state with the majority of the state's representatives controlling that vote. The majority of states are actually Republican-controlled right now. And so on the one vote per state basis, they would be able to determine who's going to be the president. But there's a scenario in which they might determine to make the former Republican governor the president instead of a candidate who probably will have driven them crazy by then. So there's a possibility of a Libertarian president and a Republican vice president, assuming the Republicans keep control of the U.S. Senate, which they may not. It should be an interesting situation. It's possible even that the Democrats could take control of a majority of the House, but still have a minority of the state delegations. And so the Republicans would still have a voice in who becomes president. It's a very unusual year. And I think there will be a number of events that will be occurring which will make it even more unusual.
You think Bernie should be among those top people?
No, I think Bernie Sanders is, you know, all right, he's okay on foreign policy and some social issues, but his economic views are so far from anything that's rational that we really don't want him around. I mean, it's sad that you know, New Hampshire, the most fiercely libertarian state, is right next door to Vermont, the most fiercely progressive state. You know, so it's an interesting thing. We should compare those two states someday and see which one is the better one to live in. But I'm not happy with his views on economics. The truth of the matter is that if we took 100% of all the personal income of the top 1%, we would not be able to run the federal government for more than a few weeks. So it's not a matter of not taxing the rich enough. It's a matter of a bloated government. And he's unable to see how bloated it is, and he would be never able to deal with cutting out the fat. And, of course, in order for us to restore the republic, we have to cut out not just the fat, but the sinews, the muscles, and the bones as well. That until the federal government is back to its, 13 specific purposes, we're going to have bigger and bigger booms and busts. And when we're going to have generation after generation paying the price. Right now, the price is being paid. The generation of people from 45 to 55 is dying younger. The tipping point has been reached, and there's a generation, a cohort, the 45 to 55-year-old cohort, which are losing ground in terms of longevity compared to their parents. first time in American history, or at least in 150 years or 200 years of American history, that a cohort hasn't expected to live longer, or at least even have a greater longevity than its parents. And the cohort before that does seem to be heading in the same direction. Now the cohort after that, the 55 to 65 year olds, the 65 to 75 year olds, you know, basically the baby boomers, they don't seem to be exhibiting that, although there are a lot of problems that baby boomers have in terms of the residual of drug use. But it does seem to be a tipping point going on. And Major General Bert Stubblebine, the president of Natural Solutions Foundation, has written about that very powerfully. Now, I'd recommend people go to drrimatruthreports.com. That's D-R-R-I-M-A, truthreports.com. And go to the blog and go back or search Bert, B-E-R-T. You'll get all of General Bert's articles on this powerful issue of this tipping point where we are now beginning to see the results of decades of depopulation efforts finally, if you will, coming true. And what we're seeing is the die-off is beginning. Why?
Probably
vaccination more than anything else.
Over the years, you have recommended that we write to our congresspeople, but I'm really seeing that the media is even controlling them. Is there something that we can do against the media? Social media, yes, but I'm talking about NBC, ABC, these people that put out such tainted.
Well, the mass media becomes less and less relevant. I mean, they're making a lot of noise, but they're getting a smaller and smaller audience. You know, so it is, you know, to me, that's all a passing phase. The latest developments in technology are moving the computing and connecting capacity into, you know, things that are wearable, into things that are flexible. You're going to be so surrounded by media in the future that you're not going to have a television screen going, because anything that you want is going to be literally in front of you. I believe that we're very close to being quite saturated with media, and I don't think the old media is going to be able to keep up with it at all. So I think that that there are a lot of changes happening that way. I believe that we're going to see the use of the media in the future making even bigger impact on politics. But I don't know yet. It depends on whether there's a soft landing from the destruction of the dollar, or whether there's a big break up, a big falls to the floor. We'll see. I don't believe that the people who presently control the federal government have enough economic sense to do what would have to be done when the dollar collapses, which is to repeal the legal tender law and allow the financial marketplace to solve the problem. But they're not going to be, because politicians have to do something, don't they? I mean, even if what they do is wrong, they have to do something. And that's the problem. So as long as we have, we need Calvin Coolidge.
I want to ask a very selfish question, because we've talked about the price of pharmaceuticals going up,
yeah,
the idea of wages going down,
mm-hmm,
and that people don't have access to health care. How do you see bioacoustics fitting into this?
Well, I think that that the future of medicine is energy, and the future of self-help is energy. I think that the huge, very expensive systems that exist right now, the hospitals and similar systems, are about as practical in the long run as medieval cathedrals. And unlike medieval cathedrals, which we want to preserve for their beauty, no one's going to want to preserve modern hospitals. I don't believe that in another generation they're going to be around. And I think that people are going to be quite capable of self-help using very powerful energetic techniques, among which I certainly expect to see human bioacoustics.
There are some things, shifting just a little bit, there are some things that we the people can do even in the court and making rules of law. Can you explain to people what jury nullification is and how they can become involved and would seeing that people
to.
Don't get.
We have, what, about 10 minutes. Okay, before we do that, talking about lawsuits and talking about California, you know, yesterday, the day before yesterday, excuse me, the lawsuit was filed in California challenging the no jab, no school law, SB 277, that was adopted by the crony corrupt legislature of California and signed into law by Governor Jerry Brownshirt, the governor of California, formerly known in his first incarnation as governor, was it back in the 1970s? As Governor Moonbeam, now that the velvet glove has come off of the iron fist, he's now known as Governor Jerry Brownshirt, having shown his true colors and his true belief system by adopting not just that law, but another one, SB 792, which says if you work in child care, you personally must be fully vaccinated, or at least vaccinated with whatever's on their list, and an employer who knowingly employs an unvaccinated person can go to jail. So Jerry Brownshirt and his fascist cohorts are turning California rapidly into some parody of a third world dictatorship. But it won't last. The law is really clear. What they're doing is illegal. You cannot condition a constitutional right. And in California, the Constitution says every child has a right to a so-called free public education. You can't condition a constitutional right on surrendering another right. You can't say to people, you have to, in order to exercise this right, you must surrender that right, and that right being the right of informed consent. And you got to learn about the right of informed consent, folks. It is your ultimate right, and I'd love to spend a whole program talking about that one. But you want to talk instead, Sherry, you had a specific question on a slightly different legal issue. Please repeat that question so the folks can hear it.
That if we go to court and become part of the jury and somebody's being ramrodded, we can do jury nullification. How do we do that?
A juror with the courage to stick to his or her convictions can say to the other jurors at any point along the way, I'm going to refuse to vote for conviction because I think this law is wrong. And a jury has the right of jury nullification to refuse to convict despite the law when our sense of justice requires us to refuse. This is an ancient right. We always have it. Judges will admit we have it, but they don't have to say it to us when they're up on the bench, which is a terrible ruling, by the way, that was made in response to the famous Brothers Barragan case involving the dumping of blood on draft records back in the Vietnam War, and the court, the judge refused to tell the jury about jury nullification, and the higher court said, yeah, you don't have to tell them about it. It's a right, we recognize it, but judges don't have to tell them about it. In fact, a judge can say, you must accept the law the way I tell you. Jury nullification says, oh yeah, we can accept that that's the law, but we can say, not guilty anyway, because we have that power, we have the veto. We are, in Lysander Spooner's words, the last bulwark against tyranny. In fact, I would say that any American who serves on a jury in which there's any political aspect and who doesn't claim the right of jury nullification is part of the problem, not part of the solution. I think that if you're on a jury and there's it's for a victimless crime or for a thought crime or the person has been accused of collecting their own rainwater or growing food crops in their front lawn or whatever it might be, you must refuse to convict. And even if the other 11, you say to them, look, I'm getting paid $25 a day to be here. I'm going to sit here until you all agree. Or we tell them it's a hung jury. Your choice, folks. I am refusing to vote guilty because it's against my conscience. That's jury nullification. Jury nullification is when one individual can stand against tyranny and make it stick.
That's incredible. We have so many questions. People want you to repeat the information about California and those laws, how they got
passed. Go to opensourcetruth.com. Opensourcetruth.com. And there's an article, it's probably four or five articles ago, so you may have to scroll down. There's an article on that lawsuit. We have some quotes from the complaint. And by the way, I've been reading the complaint. I had some input on the original preparation of the lawsuit, although I didn't get a chance to read the final complaint until just now. There is some information in there that suggests that Jerry Brownshirt has blinked and has issued some sort of a signing statement when he signed the law, saying, well, this doesn't really affect religious exemption. It certainly, from the wording of the bill, it certainly looks like it did. So the situation in California is, if I may say so, up in the air, but I believe that a federal judge will enjoin the enforcement of the bill anyway until the final decision is made. So I think that that's going to be moot, as they say. And I believe that it's real clear that if the court is afraid to publicly come out and defend the right to informed consent and say that the legislature of California has no authority to change the law of informed consent, because the law of informed consent is international law and state legislators can't change international law, that at least they can come out and say you're conditioning a public right, a right to public education, on surrendering other rights to privacy, and you can't do that. That's called an unconstitutional condition. So I believe that they'll go at least that far. Let's see if we can get a couple of more questions in the last 5 minutes.
Ralph, if people want to get in touch with you and ask you questions, do they just get in touch through your website?
They can do it, yeah. My vitamin consultancy website, it's vitaminconsultancy.com, has a contact form on it, absolutely. And that's a good way to do it. And Facebook, you know, find me on Facebook. I get lots of messages through Facebook direct messaging.
I have what I know is not a quick question, but I can't help myself, and especially because I was just seeing this. I'm trying to find the link where I just saw this, where you're talking about that open source truth, and again, being a Californian and knowing the people who had the DEA kick in their doors practically, what do you feel about the decriminalization potential, this weird schism we have in California? And I know many cannabis users, medicinal, not just people who are getting high, not only
right.
people who are getting high, but people who are using it for medicinal purposes, specific, you know, whether it be an immune
mm-hmm.
issue or a lymphatic, you know,
yep.
lipomas or, I mean, numerous things. And in California, people are like, I have my card, I'm legal. And then we have this raging example of what I've been ranting about. No, the feds can still do whatever they want. And so the feds come in and bust down this perfectly clean, well-operated, meets all the rules. And the feds come in and kick in their doors and take their equipment and basically shut them down for a week. And I can't use this word on air, blank their operations up.
Right, and
is there
when you read the 2013,
do?
Look up a Google 2013 DOJ medical marijuana statement, and the DOJ says it's not going to be doing that. But apparently, we have a federal government that is so bloated, that is so filled with overarmed and dangerous individuals in various federal agencies that they act like loose cannons and they leave people dead and destroyed. And until we reduce the size and scope of the federal government, until we take the guns away from them, they're the ones who need to be disarmed. You know, people, they were going to have more and more people killed. You know, more Americans have been shot, have been caught in crossfire by the police and killed since 9/11 than died on 9/11. It's time for us to realize that we must have criminal law reform. We must have a reduction in the size of the federal gulag and the state gulags, that this country cannot survive as a free republic with the type of social control through incarceration that this government has bought into. And only Johnson and Weld are talking about making changes to the insanity. And if they don't make
changes,
there's very little time left, folks.
I know we're going to run out of time.
Yep.
But do you feel that it's possible, in your opinion, do you think it's possible that somebody like this group that raided this agency, I happen to know some of the people that work at this operation, it's north
yep.
of where I live, and I think we've interviewed some of the people through Martin
yep.
Lee with this very operation called CBD, or
right.
I just know that that's their
yeah, by the way,
URL.
CBDs are not illegal. CBD is a natural part of the human body.
But that didn't stop the DEA from closing
them
down.
Right, they are a bunch of armed thugs.
Back to
do you feel safe yet, folks? You know?
No. Why? I'll feel safe. And do you think that it's possible that a rogue group of DEA agents decided, no, we're going to kick in their door because they're afraid that their toys and weapons and guns and the power that they've been emblazoned with could be taken away? Do you think that's a...
And I'm going to go one step further. For the good of this country and the survival of this republic, those toys have to be taken away. It's either going to be that or there's going to end up being a civil war in this country. And, you know, when you talk about only a couple of million members of the NRA, it's true. But there are 100 million Americans who own a gun, one or more guns. You know, and I really pray every day for peace, literally. But here we are at the end of the show. Let's all pray for peace.
I have a throwaway question, yes or no. Is Hillary guilty of treason by way of her email scams?
Based on the definition of treason in the U.S. Constitution, no.
Okay, what is she guilty of?
Violating some regulations having to do with emails, you know, and she should have, you know, all she had to say was, look, I used that because I didn't trust the government's email system. And she probably would have gotten away with it. But I think she may not get away with it, and this could be the end, and Bernie could end up being the last socialist standing. And then we'll have the billionaire versus the socialist, and let's hope that Johnson and Weld win. All right.
Thank you, Ralph.
Thank you, folks.
This has been a whirlwind of information.
All right. Looking forward to being with you in an hour, Sherry.
Yes, for all of you who are bioacoustic practitioners, we are ready to open our portal to the public so that you can jump on and do all of your bioacoustic work online. It is a monumental, historic day because it's going to allow much more freedom for people doing bioacoustic work and much more access. And we are having a two-day workshop on the 7th and 8th. It's going to be about Alzheimer's. And I just have an article just sent to me about tetrahydrocannabinoids, THC, and how they have found a protein there that will relieve amyloid plaque in the brain. So we are going to decode those numbers and have that information ready for you on the 7th and 8th. Workshop. It is free. The software is free. And if anybody would like me to send you a flyer so that you can distribute to your people, that would be great.
Ralph, thank you so much. We could spend hours.
Pleasure.
There's so many questions and so many mini rants that
hey,
I want
to
bounce.
Let's continue later. Let's do another show. That's all.
We'll do another show. Informed consent. I want to do a whole show. You're right. I think that's a great show.
It's real important. It is.
Sherry
as
and I will
says,
talk about that because we need to really understand. My desire is, A, to end lobbying in Congress, and, B, for us to understand that we, the people, actually can still hold our rights up and wave them
and
around.
And make a difference.
And make a difference.
Yeah, we want to make a difference.
Insert expletive of your choice. Okay, everybody, have a great 4th, and thanks again, Ralph. That was, as always, smashing.
And God bless America.
Thank you.
Yeah.